My name is Leonard Leo, and I serve as Executive Vice President of the Federalist Society. It is a privilege for me to welcome all of you to this year's National Convention. It's heartwarming to see so many familiar faces, but it's also exciting to welcome a number of newcomers to today's gathering. We come together here in Washington, D.C. each year for a number of different reasons. Perhaps to meet up with old friends, perhaps to obtain information about the state of our legal order and the public policy world from an array of opinion leaders with diverse perspectives, and perhaps to search out ways of becoming more involved in the Federalist Society as well as the public square more broadly. I would like to suggest, however, that there is another common objective that should bring us together, and that is to spark and sustain a thoughtful national conversation about whether our culture remains truly committed to limited constitutional government, and if so, how best to keep it that way. Now, the objects of this conversation will vary from time to time, with much of the focus this year being on the federal government's role, economic role, in our constitutional system. And as you all know, the conversation will inevitably involve the airing of quite a number of different and sometimes irreconcilable perspectives. This convention will be no different than those from previous years in this respect. But this conversation is important and worth having in any event. Now, I'm not prone to invoking Ralph Waldo Emerson, but I do think he got it right when he said that wise, cultivated, genial conversation is the last flower of civilization. Conversation is our account of ourselves. It is, in a word, how we search for and discover the truth. And truth, that which is right and just, ultimately is what propels us to work as engaged citizens in ways that have real, tangible impact on the future direction of our republic. So we begin the conversation this morning with opening remarks by United States Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, who currently serves as the ranking member of the Committee on the Judiciary. Senator Sessions, of course, is no stranger to the Federalist Society, having actively participated in its work going back to the 1980s and 1990s when he served as a United States Attorney and then as Attorney General of the state of Alabama. He has, in the United States Senate, distinguished himself as a committed originalist, seeking to undertake the enterprise of legislating with a deep regard for the Constitution as it is written and as it was understood by the Founding Fathers. We are privileged to have you here today, Senator, to start our morning with remarks about the third branch of government, whose jurisprudence obviously affects much else that we will be examining these next several days. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Senator Jeff Sessions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is truly an honor for me to participate in kicking off this 2009 Lawyers Convention. And let me say how much I appreciate Leonard Leo and his leadership and all of the team at the Federalist Society for the great contribution you make to the discussion of the law in America today. And I think it's critically important. Federalist Society are wonderful advocates for the great legal concepts that we all value. And Leonard, I particularly appreciate you and your friendship and insight into the key issues of America. And I do remember the founding of the Society since 1982. And since that time, you've served as a bulwark for the defense of the timeless principles of freedom, of objective law, judicial restraint, separation of powers, and ordered liberty. You recognize that a sound legal philosophy, objectively executed, is the source of our freedom and prosperity. I remember during the Sotomayor hearings, she had made a speech in which she quoted, and she's a fine person and in many ways just a quality person, but she made a speech in which she said about law and the difficulty of judging. She says, there's no objectivity, just a series of perspectives. And it still makes hair stand up on the back of my neck, I got to tell you. The Federalist Society's leadership and its defense of our Constitution are more critical now than ever before, and we just cannot let up. I hope that you'll leave this conference with a renewed passion for defending the great heritage of law that our forefathers have blessed us with. It's certainly a pleasure for me to be here to share with you some of my thoughts, for what they're worth, on the challenges that we face. I'd like to begin by telling three short stories. Inside the Indiana General Assembly, the Speaker of the House prepares to start the legislative day. Pursuant to the House rules, the first item on the agenda is the prayer or invocation. But the Speaker warns the pastors that mentioning Jesus Christ has been banned by court order. In a Midwestern town, a teenage girl seeks an abortion. In truth, she knows very little about what that involves, but no one takes the time to explain the procedure or its lasting effects. This, despite a state law on the books for 7 years requiring doctors to inform patients of the realities and risk of abortions. But for 7 years, a judge has blocked that statute, even though similar laws have been found constitutional by a number of courts. The third story, a criminal defendant has been sentenced to 15 years in federal prison, but the judge has taken an unusual step, very unusual. He has unexpectedly prepared the record just in case an appeal for clemency is filed, a reprieve that the judge says he, quote, hopes will happen. The 32-year-old defendant has just pled guilty to videotaping his sexual activities with two girls ages 16 and 17. So what do these have in common? The link is David Hamilton, President Obama's nominee to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, who will probably be voted on next week. Judge Hamilton's record demonstrates an adherence to a liberal activist, not liberal. That's not a problem with me or Democratic lawyers who've been active in Democratic or liberal politics. But the question for our confirmation always is, I think, for Republican members on our side, whether their personal, political, ideological views will overcome their commitment to the law. But Hamilton record, I think, is troubling, as I've just indicated. He worked for ACORN, was a litigation director for the Indiana ACLU. He has endorsed the notion that a judge's job is to, quote, write footnotes to the Constitution. I'm not sure they had a convention that he could participate in. Maybe he could write some of the Constitution. He has argued that judges, quote, need to empathize with the parties to better understand the effects of their rulings. And why did I mention Hamilton? Because Judge Hamilton was President Obama's symbolic first pick to the federal bench. And one White House official said that that nomination would, quote, set the tone for the future. I make these points to illustrate how much has changed since your last meeting here. Elections have consequences, and today we find ourselves, I think, at a legal crossroads. We are in a struggle to determine whether or not the classical Western tradition of law, one of the greatest achievements of all civilization, will continue to exist in the current form. No matter what people say of President Bush, it is indisputable that he nominated to the bench highly talented judges that are principled, competent, and faithful to the law. So they believed, as Alexander Hamilton described in Federalist 78, that judges must maintain an, quote, inflexible and uniform adherence to the rights of the Constitution. Leaders of the current administration, I fear, don't share that deep commitment to fair and objective decision making. They so badly desire, I'm afraid, to transform American society that they endanger politicizing all issues, even the courts. In doing so, they are hopefully unaware that they are risking the very moral authority of the law. And that ultimately is what gives the law its power. The essence of the crossroads we face is to be found in President Obama's so-called empathy standard, a standard he has reaffirmed repeatedly and identified as the core criterion he has in filling vacancies on the federal bench. According to the president, the, quote, critical ingredient, close quote, for judges is the, quote, depth and breadth of their empathy, as well as their, quote, broader vision of what America should be. This is a stunning declaration, I think. To those of us who've dedicated our professional lives to the law, this standard stings the ears. Under the president's standard, the Constitution is no longer, I would suggest, the supreme law of the land. Instead, each court, allowing empathy to be its to control, becomes a constitutional convention unto itself. Control by the judge's own personal vision for societal change and political transformation. So this is what I call the siren call of activism. Under this standard, the historic judicial oath that judges take, quote, to administer justice without respect to persons, to, quote, do equal right to the poor and the rich, and to act, quote, faithfully and impartially under the Constitution and laws of the United States, is replaced by a new approach. This new approach frees this lifetime appointed, unaccountable politically, judge from the restraints of impartiality and constitutional justice and permits him to evolve the law to achieve their desired outcome. In short, the empathy standard is a politically new but carefully chosen code word for the old and brazen form of judicial activism this society has done so much to resist. Consider the words of Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who President Obama proudly announced he selected using the empathy criteria. In her speeches, she repeatedly said that it was right and natural that a judge's, quote, opinions, sympathies, and prejudices, close quote, would influence their decision-making and for their personal experiences to affect the facts a judge chooses to see. In other words, judges should not weigh the scales of justice with a blindfold objectively, but rather with their fingers pressed on the scales. And this is the fatal flaw of empathy. Empathy for one party can only be prejudice against the other. Is that justice? Is that consistent with the great ideals of American law? So if we follow the road paved by the empathy standard, if we abandon the legacy of objective jurisprudence rooted firmly in the Constitution and our legal heritage, we risk losing not only our magnificent legal system, but the very liberties our founders built that system to protect. The founders created a court system that was to be independent, impartial, restrained. All judges must be committed to these ideals if they're fit to serve on the bench. As Alexander Hamilton noted, courts cannot fairly judge laws if they have a hand in making them, nor can they be counted on to curb the excesses of power if they share in it. Today, we see that Alexander Hamilton's fears were not unfounded. Even as the president nominates activists to the bench, judges are now setting national policy based on their views, I think. We've already seen judges declaring that the words "under God" be removed from the Pledge of Allegiance and barring students from even a silent prayer at school. Yet we have, I'd note, a paid chaplain at the Senate that prays at each one of our sessions. Judges have dismissed the people's right to their property, saying the government can take a person's home for the purpose of developing a private shopping center so the city can collect more tax revenue. Judges have cited foreign laws, world opinion, and a United Nations resolution to determine what the United States Constitution says about a state law. Constitution passed in 1789. To regulate global warming, the court found that the definition of a pollutant in the Clean Air Act of 1970, before global warming was a gleam in somebody's eye, now they've held it includes the clean, naturally occurring carbon dioxide, plant food, as a pollutant. And this would has some real effect. The effect is to give the EPA huge power over our economy, a power Congress would never have given in 1970 and wouldn't vote for today. And in the case, and in a case with important ramifications for our national security, five Supreme Court justices reversed a long string of precedents to hold that foreign enemy combatants had a right to challenge their military detention in U.S. courts. And, of course, there are more examples. Well, two paths lie ahead. One path leads to a rejuvenation of America's great legal heritage, a reaffirmation of the values of objective, impartial justice, and a renewed commitment to the legal principles on which our way of life depends. The other path leads us to a rejection of those values and principles and a continued slide to a postmodern society, a brave new world where words and facts no longer have real meaning. When words are bereft of meaning, no right, no liberty is safe. And where the greatest political document ever created, our Constitution, is thereby undermined. Where politics rules every corner of the government, and where a legacy of American exceptionalism won through the toil and sacrifice of American heroes in every generation slowly slips away. The question before us is this: do we preserve our heritage of law and justice for our children, or do we allow it to erode on our watch? We are in a long and difficult fight, and these are the stakes. We must put the debate squarely to the American people. And we can take comfort in knowing that they are on our side consistently. We've seen it time and again. Even Justice Sotomayor was quick to distance herself from her activist record and prior statements and the empathy standard announced by the president who selected her. Why? Because under the cold light of day, I think she knew her prior statements could not be defended as an operable judicial philosophy. It will not hold up. The American people want judges who follow the law, not make it, who put principle before politics, who put the evidence before their empathy, and who put what the Constitution says before what they wish it said. Simply put, Americans want judges in the mold envisioned by Alexander Hamilton, not David Hamilton. Yet the president, any president is entitled to a degree of deference regarding his nominees, and most of his nominees will undoubtedly be accepted, and most will be, I'm sure, able to handle a job on the bench. But I also believe that deference extends only as far as the nominee is committed and faithful to the Constitution and laws of this country, the laws and Constitution they're sworn to uphold. Some say our concerns are exaggerated and imaginary. I don't think so. I cannot and will not allow the easy confirmation of an individual who seeks a lifetime appointment to use that power of office to advance their own social or political agenda. I cannot and will not cast my vote in favor of a judge who will put his own prejudices and politics on a higher mantle than the law, the facts, and objective truth. I cannot and will not stand idly by as the Senate confirms a nominee that will use their authority to diminish rather than defend the Constitution of this great republic. And when a judge alters the meaning of the words of the Constitution to affect a result the judge would like to see, is not the entire document weakened and all our liberties placed at greater risk? So the road ahead will not be easy. Again, the fight will be long. It will be tough. It will require strength and intellectual rigor to see it through. But it's a fight we can win. We will win. And it's a fight with which I'm proud to stand with you, shoulder to shoulder, every step of the way. Thank you so much.
We have a few minutes before we move into our first plenary session. So the senator has graciously agreed to stay with us for a few more minutes and to take questions. There are microphones on the side aisles. If people who wish to ask questions should line up, and then the senator will field them.
While people are gathering, I would just want to say how much I appreciate the great team we have on the Judiciary Committee. We're outnumbered 12-7. That's a huge majority on a committee in the Senate. But you got great constitutional lawyers who've studied these issues, like Orrin Hatch and John Kyle and John Cornyn and Lindsey Graham. And then we've got two non-lawyers in Chuck Grassley and Tom Coburn, who've got courage and insight from the real world. And I think it's a pretty good mix, and I was proud of them and the work that they did in, I think, creating the kind of discussion we'd like to have with the American people on the Sotomayor nomination. What question? Yes.
Senator, notwithstanding the fact that the Obama administration hasn't sent up a tremendous number of nominations, particularly for the courts of appeals, I understand there's a proposal to pack the lower court, so to speak, by enlarging the number of both appellate and district court judges. Where are those going this year and next year?
I think we need to question that very aggressively, the expansion of the number of judges. My staff people give me these notes almost every day because we get complaints about it. There are 21 circuit court vacancies. There have been 11 nominations by the Obama administration. There are 75 district vacancies. Only 10 nominations have been submitted to the Senate. We've confirmed 7. And you hear them whine and wail about how they're being held up. And we are. So my view is if they've got a nominee that's not a good nominee, we're going to resist. And if the nominee is one that's capable of handling the office and has got integrity and ability and is committed to following the law, whether they like it or not, then I think that nominee will be able to move forward. With regard to the expanded numbers, we had testimony that the caseload of the federal court had increased district courts 27% since 1990. That sounded at first bad, and then I started thinking, well, that's not so bad. I would have thought it was a lot worse than that. And we also know that the highest, almost I think the highest caseload circuit is the 11th Circuit, my circuit, Florida, Alabama, and Georgia, and that they don't want any more judges. They said that they can handle this higher caseload. They can maintain collegiality and coherence as a circuit better. So I have real dubious. And, of course, federal judges have more clerks today, more computers. Magistrates do more work. More cases are being pled. You know, 97-98% of criminal cases plead today, and almost as high a number of civil, maybe that high. So I'm going to show me how you need a whole lot of judges. I'm sure some districts, you know, probably are in a critical thing, and we'll need to look at it.
I'm from Mississippi. I'm familiar with a potential nominee from the President's party for a district court vacancy who won't take the job because he can't afford the pay cut. Is there any appetite in this administration for improvement of judicial pay so that qualified people will take the job?
No, there's not any appetite for that. not from me. We got plenty of applications, it seems, when nominations come up. I'm kidding. I ask them, you know. I asked Judge Roberts one final question. Judge, can you live on the pay? You know, don't take it if you can't. Kind of kidding, but, of course, what a month went and gone by, and he was there asking for a pay raise. And reminded me carefully, stated he didn't promise not to ask. And there's certainly no rule against asking. I wish we could just give everybody what we'd like to give them. But we can't. I mean, the deficit this country has this year, you remember Bush was attacked for spending. His highest deficit was $450 billion. That was last year. This year, we just finished September 30th. $1.4 trillion, $1,400 billion deficit 1 year. The total debt last year of the country, public debt, the hardcore public debt that we owe outside people, was $5.7 trillion from the founding of the republic. In 5 years, according to CBO's score of President Obama's budget, and this does not include health care, it would be $11.7 trillion, doubled, and will triple to $17 trillion in 10 years. I see the Brits have said, the conservatives have said, that they're going to freeze pay, you know, and that kind of thing. But I think we've never seen anything like this flood of debt. And all of us are going to have to ask ourselves what we can do. And I think the government people are going to have to take some leadership role in containing what we do. But I understand, you know, what does a baseball player who can hit 360 and 40 home runs get paid? I don't know. Yes.
Senator, could you comment, talk a little bit about your views about the constitutionality of a federal mandate that every citizen of the United States purchase health care, and might the upcoming debate in the Senate be a good opportunity to talk to the citizens about the Constitution as a limitation on the federal government's power?
I think that's a good question. Matter of fact, I met with my staff. I think Brian Benchkowski is here. Where's Brian? My chief staff director on the Judiciary Committee, because he was Attorney General McCasey's chief of staff and staff director on the House Judiciary Committee, and does a great job. But we were talking about, and you know what I said, Leonard? I said, we ought to ask Federalist Society folks what they think, too. You know, I said, let's begin to think about that question, and what is the constitutional thing. So I think it's well worth looking at. Can the government require you to do what we think is in your best interest if you don't think it's in your best interest? What interstate commerce? I don't know what connection. So it would be an interesting question to think about. And if any of you are aware of research on it, we'd love to hear it.
Senator, as a prosecutor from North Carolina, I'm concerned about the changing makeup of the Fourth Circuit. And in light of that, what is Senator Leahy's current interpretation of the blue slip rule as it applies to circuit judges?
Well, they were able to block four and maintain four vacancies for a number of years. Judge Andre Davis, as a prosecutor, that went on the Fourth Circuit, just confirmed. I spoke about a series, I think five of his criminal cases that were not good, all reversed by the Fourth Circuit. And it bothered me a good bit. The more I studied it, the more bothered I was. So I think they do have a desire to enlighten the Fourth Circuit, and make it better, and it looks like law enforcement, Mr. Prosecutor, is not one of their high priorities in this deal. With regard to blue slips, the rule still applies on district judges that home state senators do have the ability to object and effectively block a nominee if they think they're unfit, but it's not a pleasant thing to do. Nobody likes to do that. And sometimes the administration will talk with senators in advance about what they're considering. Sometimes they really don't. Brian, where's Brian? Is he here? Speak up. Has there been any change that are you aware of with regard to the blue slip on the circuit nominees where you got multiple states involved? And has Leahy announced anything? He was just saying he thinks that he has respected that process since he's been on the other side a number of times, and we all have. Anything else? We'll be wrestling with the question. A lot of us have resisted filibusters of judges, thinking it's not a good thing. Justice Thomas was confirmed 50-248, for example, and the Democrats didn't filibuster then. We never filibustered during the Clinton years. Holes held nominees up, but when judges were called up, for example, I would vote for cloture to move to the nominee if the leader brought it up, and then we'd vote against the nominee. That was the pattern, and the Democrats railed against Republicans, accusing them of the whole process that slowed nominees down and allowed time to debate and that kind of thing, that they were filibustering. But if you remember in 2000, y'all all need to know this, sophisticated crowd, just some of you know and need to be reminded, Democrats had a conference after Bush got elected. So no longer would Clinton be nominating, Bush would be nominating. So they met with Lawrence Tribe and Marsha Greensburger and Cass Sunstein, and they made a proposal to change the ground rules. And within months, Jim Jeffords switched parties, and they had the majority. And they didn't move nominees in committee. The first eight nominees, Bush, or eight or ten he put up, two were Democrats, and one was a renomination. They promptly confirmed them and blocked all the rest of them. Years went by. One of the seats was the Fourth Circuit seat that they just filled. It was 9 years vacant. And they filibustered systematically, never once blushed. You know, just a month before they were attacking Republicans for filibustering, then they were leading filibusters. And so that went on, and we had these fabulous nominees that were being blocked. And Bill Frist worked and worked and worked, and for 2 years we finally got the American people engaged. The pressure started building. People like Priscilla Owen or Bill Pryor and all those fabulous nominees that were being blocked, Janice Rogers Brown, and they finally broke. The way it happened was the Gang of 14, and they said, well, you shouldn't filibuster except in extraordinary cases. And so we got about five or six of that group through, of the eight or ten that were being blocked. And so I'm kind of the view that I guess that's the new rule. Normally we don't filibuster, but if the extraordinary circumstances exist, I suspect that's where we're going to come out. We just have to live with how the Senate operates. You don't want to unilaterally disarm. But that's kind of some of the thinking that we're wrestling with in the Senate today about how to make sure that the process works in its historic way. Leonard, good to be with you. Thanks to all of you for what you do.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you, Ken.
Good to see you.
Good. Thank you.
Senator, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us, and we wish you well as your body engages in some very important debates, and we do hope that you will take time as a body to talk about to think about the constitutional issues relating to a number of the initiatives that will be discussed throughout the several days of our conference. So we're going to go right into the next panel. And so if the panelists can please begin to come up to the dais. And Senator, good to see you, and we'll look forward to seeing you hopefully tonight or during some other time during the conference. Thank you.